Hello, everyone. This is Bill Vondahar with another edition of Moments in History. Last episode that we had, we read about an international champion aviatrix, the life of Catherine Stinson. She became a pilot when there was only about three or four other women pilots in the world. And this is back in 1917. That was in the History magazine, August, September 2019. Today we found a different article about other women aviators that happened after, maybe somewhat at the same time, but basically after Catherine Stinson. This is an American History magazine, December 2019, and it's entitled Women with Wings. This is written by Liesl Bradner. Liesl Bradner writes, the 1929 Powder Puff Derby showed women could hold their own in the air. The article begins, in the 1920s, when civilian aviation was organizing itself and aviators were setting benchmark upon benchmark, air races were a popular spectator sport. The all-women's air derby, as it was known officially, drew crowds to see and meet record setters, nonconformists, and all bands between. At the extremes flew unassuming Amelia Earhart, a demure daredevil from Atchison, Kansas, and Bohemian Florence Pancho Barnes, a Union Army balloonist granddaughter. She declared, "Flying makes me feel like a sex maniac in a whorehouse with a stack of $20 bills." Endurance flyer Evelyn Bobby Trout was known for flying by night and living to tell the tale. Ruth Elder financed flying lessons with her beauty contest winners. Feminist Opal Kuntz's husband, George, was chief mineralogist at Tiffany's and well able to keep her in planes. Blanche Noyes flew for the Air Mail Service. Stylish Alabaman Ruth Elder had failed in 1927 to become the first woman to fly from Long Island to Paris, France. She was forced to ditch in the Atlantic, but the attempt had earned her dinner at the White House and a Manhattan ticker tape parade. These and fellow competitors, pint-sized Vera Dawn Walker, banker's daughter Neva Paris, test pilot's wife Claire May Fay, and more, took off from Clover Field, now Santa Monica, California Municipal Airport, on August 19, 1929, aiming to log the fewest air hours reaching Cleveland, Ohio. That nine-day journey killed one racer, made the survivors famous, and signaled American women's full-fledged entry into aviation. Between its early 1900s inception and the decade following the Great War, aviation evolved dramatically. Aircraft went from dual-winged contraptions of wood, fabric, and wire, puddle jumping along at 80 miles an hour, and landing in whichever farm field presented itself, to sleek metal monoplanes able to exceed 200 miles an hour and travel great distances. The airborne future seemed and looked limitless. To seduce passengers away from railroads, airlines needed larger, faster, and safer aircraft, but also terminals at which to take on and dispense travelers and their luggage. Dearborn, Michigan's Ford Airport was the first such facility to offer comfortable waiting and boarding areas, though it was not unusual for passengers to get a face full of prop-washed grit. Grass airfields hung on until the 1930s. The airplane industry echoed the automobile's introduction, with scores of manufacturers opening, closing, merging, and acquiring one another. Unlike car makers with their assembly lines, the aircraft industry emphasized craftsmanship, often hand-building planes one by one from the wheels up. Also, unlike the auto industry, which was concentrated around Detroit, Michigan, the aircraft industry had no geographic hub. Headquarters and factories dotted the map. Bell and Curtis Wright in Buffalo, New York, Republican Grumman on Long Island, Boeing in the Northwest, and later Wichita, Kansas, Los Angeles, California. They were home to Douglas, Lockheed, Northrop, North American, and Voltee. Charles Lindbergh's heroic 1927 transatlantic solo flight legitimized flying as a skill, a source of celebrity, and a business proposition, attracting millions in investment and stoking public interest in flying as a means of travel and in flyers as a new category of star. In 1929, 9,098 men held flying licenses in the United States. So did 117 women. Those among the latter tried to make a living at flying had few permanent career options. Many had to resort to air circuses, traveling carnival-style troops of aviators setting up for business for a few days in the hinterland to entertain crowds with wing-walking and trick flying, as aviatrix Phoebe Omley and husband Vernon did for a living, and barnstorming in the air from town to town, sometimes solo, to spin up deals to get paid for aerial stunts. The film industry offered opportunities as a stunt woman or stand-in. Wealthy women took up flying for the challenge and the notoriety. On June 24, 1929, Opal Kuntz made page one of the New York Times for crashing her newly purchased cream and gold travel air biplane at Morris Plains, New Jersey, with an ex-sailor aboard. Kuntz promptly bought another travel air, which she then christened Betsy Ross, by Miss Thomas Edison at Newark Metropolitan Airport. Wellesley educated stockbroker's daughter Ruth Nichols took flying lessons on the sly. Evelyn Trout began flying at the age of 17 with money earned at the family filling station in Southern California. Emulating star dancer Irene Castle, Trout cropped her black hair, dressed mannishly, and went by the name Bobby. "She looks like a boy, but flies like a man," a reporter wrote. Inspired by Lindbergh, Ruth Elder, age 23, learned to fly. Hollywood picked her for lead roles in the 1928 Paramount vehicle Moran of the Marines, Paramount 1928, and Universal's 1929, The Winged Horseman. Women had long been making news in the air, pushing back against a aviation culture, patriarchal. Harriet Quimby flew the English Channel in 1912, 3 years after Louis Berlert was the first man to achieve the feat. In 1921, former wing walker Phoebe Omley broke the world parachute jump record. In 1921, Louise Thaden flew to 2,260 feet, a record for female aviators. On June 18, 1928, Amelia Earhart, accompanied two male pilots, flew the Atlantic in a Fokker trimotor, just a year after Charles Lindbergh's famous New York-Paris solo flight. Global certifying body FAI, Federation Aeronautical International, classified these achievements as miscellaneous air performance. In the same vein, air race organizers, all male, refused to let women compete. That barrier stood still until 1929, when in collaboration with promoter Cliff Henderson, who during World War I had flown with the 101st Aero Squadron, announced the all-women's air derby. Adhering to mainstream model, the 2,700-mile route between Santa Monica, California, and Cleveland, Ohio, involved multiple days, many stops, and much ballyhoo. To have a shot at the $25,000 first prize, a prospect needed National Aeronautics Association pilot's license and 100 hours of solo flight, including 24 hours of soloing cross-country. She also had to be a certified airplane mechanic. The race drew 70 applicants, of which 40 qualified, and 20 entered, including the German aerobot Thea Rasky, the Flying Fraulein as she was known, and petite Australian Jessie Maud Chubby Miller, first woman to pilot a plane from England to Australia. Racers' rides varied widely in engine displacement, prompting the sponsor to divide the field. Flyers whose aircraft engines displaced 510 cubic inches or less were lightweights. Anything with a bigger bore was a heavyweight. The dominant model was an open cockpit biplane with a 510 or 800 cubic foot engine built by Travel Air since 1925 in Wichita, Kansas, which billed itself as the air capital of the world. Travel Air executive Walter Beach, who thought having female aviators race would sell airplanes, helped bring about the event. So, at noon on August 18, 1929, Santa Monica seaside morning fog was burning off and Clover Field was buzzing. Humorist and aviation enthusiast Will Rogers, with flyer and sidekick Willie Post, was there to cover the race for his Gulf Oil radio show. Seeing the competitors primping for the press, Rogers, coining a catchphrase, cracked, "Looks like a powder puff derby to me." Earhart, who had flown into Santa Monica in her shiny red heavyweight five-passenger Lockheed Vega, she was favored to win. Officials decided the 300-horsepower Travel Air Opel Kuntz had just bought was too much aircraft for a woman. She rented a 200-horsepower Travel Air. Edith Fulce fired up the Kinner 5 engine in her Alexander Eagle Rock Bullet, a stylistic standout with its tractable gear, underslung wing, and an enclosed cabin. Fulce, a clothes horse, had a custom lavender flying suit that she called a Fulsup, tailored for flying and ground-bound casual wear. Earhart, Thaden, and Marvel Croson were worried that Mary Hayslip, age 19, who had learned to fly from her World War I aviator husband Jimmy, she was missing. Word came that a plane had gone down in a nearby field. The woman recognized it as stunt pilot Phoebe Omley's monocoupe. Omley, who had lost her way in the fog, was about to be jailed for smuggling dope when Earhart intervened. The sheriff deputies let the other woman off. Pancho Barnes arrived in a beret, smoking her usual cigar. Among the 3,000 spectators were Edward Rice Burroughs, author of the Tarzan series, another celebrity, Tool fortune Howard Hughes shyly wished Croson good luck, himself an aviator. Hughes was sponsoring 4'11" Vera Dawn Walker in a Curtis Robin. To reach the rudder pedals, Walker had to prop herself forward with pillows. Until Hughes intervened, she had been stuck for a sponsor. The San Bernardino Lug took the aviators 68 miles east once they were able to get going. Mishaps abound. Earhart had to turn back to unstick her aircraft's jammed starter. Mechanical trouble delayed Haslip for a day. She arrived aboard a replacement craft. Besides staying aloft, the challenge was keeping on course without radios, using questionable charts to reach ill-marked landing fields. Savvy flyers like Barnes kept an eye peeled for railroad tracks, a reliable guide. Barnes was first to reach San Bernardino, where 4,000 spectators crowded the airport. The second day's leg was 348 miles to Calexico, California, and Yuma and Phoenix, Arizona. Earhart's propeller broke. A spare had to be flown in from Los Angeles. Trout's 100-horsepower Golden Eagle Chief cartwheeled across a field, requiring days of repair work. Airport mechanics accidentally contaminated the fuel tank of Elder's Swallow biplane with 5 gallons of oil. Landing hard amid dust clouds, Kuntz damaged her Travel Air's landing gear. When Faye, who had been having trouble maintaining control, set her Travel Air down at Calexico, she found snapped air wires that appeared to have been sabotaged with acid. The flyers next headed to Phoenix, Arizona, 150 miles northeast of San Bernardino. Barnes, following the wrong rails, veered far off course, landing in a farmer's field in Mexico. "I wheeled around, goosed the throttle, and got out of there," she recalled. Desert temperatures in a stifling cabin made Elder woozy. Losing her map to the slipstream, she landed her red swallow in a field of grazing bulls. A rancher's wife appeared, shouting that she was scaring the herd. Elder about-faced and took off. At dusk that day in Phoenix, all pilots were accounted for except Warsaw, Indiana-born Marvel Croson, age 29, who with younger brother Joe was a bush pilot in Alaska. A month before, Croson had gained fame, reaching 23,996 feet in a travel air jet J-5. Unfortunately, searchers found her corpse in the Gila River Valley, her parachute unopened, several hundred feet from the wrecked Chaparral. Decades later, the son of the travel air factory investigator who worked the case said his late father had suspected carbon monoxide poisoning in Croson's death, which dominated the next morning's front pages. Exhaust also had sickened other competitors. Race officials suggested canceling. Survivors said that they would push on to honor their fallen sister. The stops were as much work as the flying, if not more. Each destination tried to set a record for hospitality. Mayors and city councils overscheduled the aviators with charity appearances, photo sessions, and soirees. Even the most media savvy among the competitors had not reckoned with the kind of notoriety that would draw 10,000 spectators, many of them rabid autograph hounds, to an airfield outside of Wichita, Kansas. Required to keep a gallon of water and 3 days' worth of rations aboard, the flyers had little stowage, and at events often appeared clad in wrinkled frocks and sporting windburned cheeks, V-shaped tans, and goggle-induced owl eyes. Some wore plus fours under their skirts to keep them from flashing too much thigh in negotiating cockpits. By day four, racers were recovering from Marvel Croson's death. In honor of her wrong-way turn, Barnes painted Mexico or Bust in white on her travel air's fuselage. At Pecos, Texas, gawking drivers pulled onto the airstrip as competitors were landing. Colliding with a car, Barnes totaled her plane, knocking her out of the race. Accidents and illnesses continued. Mary Perry, diagnosed with typhoid fever, had to enter the hospital in Abilene, Texas. Fouled oil lines grounded Hayslip. On high, Noyes noticed her luggage smoldering. She sat down in the desert and pulled up her plane's wooden flooring to exhaust the flames with sand. On August 26, 1929, 15 of the original 20 landed at Cleveland, Ohio, Municipal Airport. Thaden came in first in the heavy class, with O'Donnell second and Earhart third. Omley, Foles, and Keith Miller led the light brigade. "To us, the successful completion of the Derby was more important than life or death," said Thaden. "The public was skeptical of airplanes and air travel. We women of the Derby were out to prove that flying was safe, to sell aviation to the layman." After a round of congratulatory effusions that included autographing one another's cloth-flying helmets, the racers gathered beneath a Cleveland Airport grandstand to talk business, specifically about forming an organization. In time, they and other women flyers, a total of 99 founding members, signed up. That November, 26 women flyers met at Curtis Airport on Long Island. Mechanics were revving a Challenger's engine as they sipped tea from a toolbox on wheels. The women had to raise their voices, nearly shouting, as they discussed jobs, locating an office for their group, and assembling files on female flyers. Membership would be open to any woman with a pilot's license. The topic of a name came up. The climbing vines? The petticoat pilots? The homing pigeons and gladflies were among the suggested names. The 99, said Earhart, referring to the charter members. The phrase stuck. The group elected Earhart president and Thaden treasurer and vice president. The Derby reprised in 1930, but soon the male-dominated air establishment was reverting to form. Florence Klingensmith's death at the 1933 Frank Phillips Trophy races in Chicago, metal stress felled her overpowered sportster, led organizers to bar women from the 1934 finals. In 1935, pressure from female flyers got that ban lifted. Thaden and co-pilot Noyes took first place in the prestigious 1936 Bendix race in a Beechcraft. The irrepressible Barnes did stunt flying on Howard Hughes's 1930 film Hell's Angels and founded the first stunt pilots union. In the 1930 Powder Puff Derby, she broke Earhart's record for speed by a woman flyer, reaching 196.19 miles per hour in a travel air type R mystery ship. Earhart, in 1931, married publisher George Putnam, flew relentlessly, soloing across the Atlantic in 1932. On a 1937 attempt to circumnavigate the globe with navigator friend Fred Noonan, Earhart vanished, a mystery beloved of curiosity seekers and conspiracy theorists. Pioneering 99 members strongly influenced American aviation through World War II. One was Jackie Cochran, an orphan from Muskegee, Florida, who grew up picking cotton, made a fortune in cosmetics, and earned a pilot's license in 3 weeks. By 1938, Cochran was considered the best female pilot in the United States. On June 18, 1941, she shuttled a Hudson V bomber across the Atlantic. Flying grandmother Colonel Ruth Cheney Streeter became the first director of the Women's Marine Corps. Civilian members served as flight instructors, air traffic controllers, and commercial airline pilots. Many 99s enlisted as Women Air Force Service Pilots, or WASP, and in the Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Squadron, which Cochran headed. Initially assigned to test fly repaired planes, the women saw their duties expand to include tracking and searchlight missions, glider towing, flying radio-controlled target planes, and delivering weapons, cargoes, and personnel. More experienced members flew for Grumman, testing naval aircraft. Louise Thaden became director of the Women's Division of the Penn School of Aeronautics. As a flight instructor, Kuntz trained several hundred U.S. Navy flyers at Rhode Island State Airport. Edith Full Stearns served in the Air Transport Auxiliary, shuttling military aircraft from factories to bases and maintenance depots. Omley established 66 flight schools in 46 states, including the facility in Tuskegee, Alabama, at which African-American airmen trained. Mary Von March conducted final inspections at Pratt & Whitney engines powering B-24 Liberator heavy bombers. Barnes headed the Women's Air Reserve. For secret post-war aviation projects, the U.S. Defense Department took over an airport that Barnes Crowd owned near Air Force Base, now Edwards Air Force Base, in Southern California's Mojave Desert. Nearby, Barnes opened Rancho Oro Verde Fly-In Dude Ranch, whose rustic bar became a test pilot hangout made notorious as the Happy Bottom Riding Club by Tom Wolfe in his 1979 book, The Right Stuff, a best-selling ode to the test pilot culture from which the American space program emerged in the 1950s. Trained by U.S. Air Force aviator Chuck Yeager, Cochran in 1952 became the first woman to break the sound barrier. At the controls of a Canadian-built F-86 Sabre jet, she set the world record of 652 miles per hour over Edwards Air Force Base. From 1949 through 1977, Cochran ran the annual all-woman transcontinental air race. She died in 1980. The Powder Puff Derby lives on as the annual women-only air race classic, a 2,400-mile, four-day event staged around North America. The next race, June 23rd through 26th, 2020, starts in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and ends in Terre Haute, Indiana. Any woman with a pilot's license can still join the 99s, which has 155 chapters worldwide. And there's a little another article that attends this, and it's called Dames in Space. The Mercury 13 was a short-lived secret attempt to put female pilots into space. Dr. William Randolph Lovelace II, head of NASA's Special Committee on Bioastronautics, who tested the Mercury 7 male astronauts, thought women's smaller frames and lower oxygen needs would make them great astronauts. Oklahoma-born 99 Jerry Cobb was the ideal candidate. First to qualify for Mercury 13 in 1961, Cobb, age 29, passed the same physical and psychological testing as the male candidates. In a sensory deprivation test, floating in darkness for 9 hours and 40 minutes, Cobb's results outdid those of the Mercury 7 astronauts. Lovelace recruited 19 more female candidates. 13 passed the same tests as the men. Mercury 13 ran aground when astronaut John Glenn spoke at a congressional hearing. "Men go off and fight the wars and fly the airplanes," Glenn said. "The fact women are not in this field is a fact of our social order." The program was canceled. "I think some of them really thought that they were going to be astronauts," said Jean Nora Jensen, Mercury 13 participant and author of Sky Girls. She would go on to fly for Beechcraft. Cobb, age 87, spent 30 years as a missionary flying supplies to remote corners of South America. December 14th through the 23rd, 1986, 34-year-old 99 Jenna Yeager, no relation to Chuck Yeager, co-piloted with Dick Rutan the first nonstop, non-fueled world circumnavigation aboard the Rutan Voyager aircraft. In July 1991, astronaut Eileen Collins traveled in space carrying one of Louise Thaden's flying helmets signed by the 1929 Powder Puff Derby racers. On July 23, 1999, as the first woman to command a space shuttle, Collins brought Amelia Earhart's scarf and a pilot license signed by Orville Wright in 1924 for Bobby Trout, the last living Powder Puff racer, aboard Russian space station Mir. And that was the end of the story written by Liesl Bradner about the women pilots. Women with Wings, the 1929 Powder Puff Derby, showed women could hold their own in the air. And that's all the time we have for today. Until next time, this is Bill Vondahar with Moments in History. Thank you for listening.